Hey, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 249th, Oliver Cromwell. My name's Dick Newman, let's get on with it. John Jenkins there. He worked for Charles. Charles thought he was pretty bloody good. But we get into Civil War and guys like John Jenkins are on their own, suddenly unemployed. So they have to wander around England, see if they can find some noble who will take them in and be their patron. He will. He's very good at his stuff. So, yeah, he'll find people to work for. But why don't we dive right on into Oliver Cromwell. Born 1599, so he's about 41 for us in podcast years. He's grown up in a time of rebellions, breakdowns and civil wars. We've opened up the Americas, we've got trade routes to the Far East. The populations all over Europe have been growing, along with inflation growing all over Europe, giving widespread economic problems. Social classes are reorganising. Governments have been trying to control these things. Yeah, governments are nowhere near in control as much as we think they are. The guys doing best economically are the duchies, but they've got a limited population and bugger all natural resources. Their economic success has led to changes in their political system and the desire to toss off their Spanish masters. The Germanic and Italian states have failed to cooperate with each other and are slipping backwards economically. They need something like a European Union, but that's way in the future. Spain, despite getting tons of stuff from the Americas, is also going backwards, and that's down to their having just super rich landholders and a fabulously rich church. Lots of their assets are in the hands of the few, which is not good for the economy at all. France is coming along nicely after all that civil war strife with merchants figuring out they need to leave power to the government and just get on with making money. England, though, has made the big breakthrough in seeking a representative assembly, a parliament, like a real one. This is to ensure the government takes into account economic considerations. The big problem we've seen with this idea is that we have the great men, those humans who are sure that they are better than the rest of us and born to rule. Parliament represents men of property, landowners. These guys were looking for more power over taxation and commercial policy, and even foreign policy would be handy for them. That's fair enough. Foreign policy affects trade and commerce. Against that, we've got the divine right of kings. Now, Gloriana probably believed in that, most of them do, but she was way too smart to even have to talk about it. Jim was certainly into it, but he had enough brains to not go too hard and sought at least to try to compromise. Charles O is full on, divine right of king, royal prerogative. He's given us arbitrary arrests, paying taxes without parliamentary approval, and then looked to rule without parliament. His and George's stupid foreign adventures have seen troops billeted in people's houses, which is something we all absolutely hate. We've had martial law imposed, and it's definitely heading towards the European model of absolute monarchy. Yeah, no thanks, Charles, is what we're saying. Population growth in England has led to a need for greater food production. Populations are growing in towns and cities, which, of course, are reliant on other places to produce their food. The trouble is we've got lots and lots of king's forests which are off-limits for agriculture. We've also seen the enclosures of common lands which led to that food production turned into grazing land, wool for exports. There's plenty of fens and marshes that could be drained, but we need a government to do that. Then there's a big question. If we could do something about it to get more agricultural land, who would control and profit? And while this land is currently unproductive for agriculture, it does support populations of very common and smelly types who would be dispossessed. Then there, of course, is religion getting in the way and the right way of how to worship the baby Jesus. That ongoing problem is just getting worse and worse in England. There's also the economy of the church. Given all that inflation, Archie Lord was raising the tithes, and Parliament see that as a taxation that's been increased without parliamentary approval. Tithes are hitting the wealthy landowners, making them unhappy. Lord's looking to control the magic show in places where landowners have had the say in the past is making them even unhappier. Civil laws have been looking to keep up with commercial considerations, the needs of the business class. The Archie's canon laws upheld in churchy courts are outdated and repressive, and we're resenting them. Excommunications, prohibitions of working on saints' days, enforcing the tithe claims, getting people to dob in their neighbours for naughty religious practices are out of step with society. Then we got the censorship and churchy control of education, along with the start of the Enlightenment, showing that that sort of education is old hat. That's all going badly for the church as well as the monarchy. Oliver Cromwell was fired when the last Tudor, Betty, died, giving us the Stuarts. It won't be long before the English are talking about Betty's golden age, when monarch, church and parliament all worked cooperatively. The church was nicely Protestant and the bishops were kept in check by secular power. Our sea dogs brought gold and glory from the filthy Spanish. No wonder Oliver's mum and Oliver's wife and Oliver's daughter were all named Elizabeth. That smart operator Betty had kept the Puritans at bay by a policy of leniency to the Catholics in England and refusing to acknowledge the Puritans. The Puritans put up with that because of her firm anti-Spanish policies. Jim simply fucked all that up, going for the Catholics and acknowledging the Puritans and looking the buddies with Spain. He bought peace, but he was actually outspending Betty. Spent more than Betty did on war. Money-grabbing Jim had bugger all success in anything. He took the monopoly on cloth exports away from the merchant adventurers and gave it to the new king's merchant adventurers, who said they would add value by dyeing the cloth in England. Nice idea, it's just that the king's merchant adventurers had no fucking idea what they were doing, which led to overproduction and a crisis. That's our biggest export industry. James had to back down and gave it back to the merchant adventurers who knew what they were doing. Around that time, Oliver was 30 and England was in disarray. Oliver Cromwell will have a spiritual crisis and decide to go Puritan. That was the peak of the Puritan migration out of England to the Americas, and it seems that was part of his decision. He wanted out of England and all the shit. The migration was organised by the Providence Island Company, whose treasurer was John Pym, our parliamentarian. Some of Oliver's cousins were members of the company. Providence Island is off the coast of South America, so Spanish-filled territory. The occupation by the English is anti-Spanish. But I'm really wandering all around the place. So, Oliver is a descendant of Sir Richard Cromwell, Tom Cromwell's nephew. Through his mum Elizabeth, he's descended from the Steward family. Her great-uncle had been the last prior of Ely and became the first Protestant dean. It was Richard Cromwell who convinced him to get on to Team Reformation. The Stewards then became farmers of the priory at Ely. It was the Cromwell side of the family who were into politics. Oliver's uncle, Sir Oliver, thought he'd have a crack at getting into the court, and there went the family fortune. He farmed. Had to sell the great house at Hinchinbrook to the Montague family. Didn't matter because our Oliver's dad was a younger son and wasn't going to inherit much anyway. Young Oliver will have plenty of rich relatives, but won't be too rich himself. Dad will die when Oliver is 18, leaving him to be brought up by Mum. In the house, Oliver had seven sisters. It's going to be a very female household he grows up in. Oliver, though, will be rough and tumble and rather boisterous. His male role model will be his teacher, Tom Beard, who is also the local Puritan preacher. He will write a book proving, yes, proving, that the Pope is the Antichrist. That might be because Archie Lord said the Pope wasn't the Antichrist. He will also write books about how we must obey God's laws. I don't know. Does he want us to stone women to death for adultery? His writing's also a bit political. Hey, look, princes cop civil wars if they're naughty, and always remember private property is sacred, even against kings, and don't forget overtaxing people is a sin. Oliver will go to Cambridge Uni, rejecting his dad's college Queens and his teacher's college Jesus, picking the new Puritan college, Sydney Sussex. He'll only be there a year when he's called back because Dad died. Yeah, told you that. Court of the Wards will look to make Oliver a ward, but somehow the family will escape that. 21-year-old Oliver will marry Elizabeth Borchia, daughter of a merchant who'd done pretty well. They're going to have 5 kiddies. Oliver at this time is a poor relative of a rich family, but the family connections are the big deal. That wider family are what we might term the opposition in Parliament types. 6 of his cousins will be sent to the slammer for refusing to pay the forced loans. Oliver will first be elected to Parliament in 1628 along with 9 of his cousins. Parliament, as we know, will be dissolved for 11 years. Oliver will then be involved in local politics. Huntingdon, where he lives, had a charter which means it has local government. That was an oligarchy for the rich kids. A Puritan group had tried to take over, and Oliver provided support for this. But with Parliament dissolved, Charles was moving to change these corporate towns to something that would definitely support him. If Parliament were to be called again, it would be fresh elections, and the corporation had huge power to swing those. The government will issue a fresh charter to reduce the current 24 aldermen to 12, and just to make sure the right guys got in, the charter named them. No need for any sort of election. Oliver will get a consolation prize. He'll be made a JP, but the opposition aren't finished. I can see one of the parts of this issuing new charters is to get more enclosures at the expense of the common smellies. Oliver will be making speeches against the corporation. Off goes Oliver to the Privy Council for a please explain. They will refer it on to Lord Privy Seal, which just happens to be the Earl of Manchester, Edward Montague, and a kind of friend of the family. He will say, nothing to see here. Oliver just spoke a bit rashly and should go and kiss and make up with the corporation, and Oliver will do that, but then he'll sell his land and move to St. Ives. It looks like political defeat because he won't be able to stand for MP in Huntingdon now. It will be a £10 fine for Oliver. What's he done wrong? He failed to buy a knighthood as ordered. So the king orders you to buy a knighthood. You say, oh, that's a stupid thing, no use to me, so no thanks. Then you cough a fine for not buying that useless thing. I think I'm starting to see why people are annoyed. Besides, Oliver has reduced status right now. He isn't a landholder. He's renting farmland. And he's no longer a justice of the peace either. Then in 1636, his rich uncle will die, leaving him a large bit of land in Ely, and suddenly he's back to being rich. But that period of renting hadn't been all rainbows and lollipops. His medical records show us that he is suffering from melancholy, and he's a hypochondriac, just like King Charles. Still, he will see the light, writing he had been in the darkness as a sinner. He's been reading the John Calvin stuff, or just copped a huge inheritance. One or the other has raised his spirits. Around this time, the towns were also fighting back against Archie Lord's anti-sermonising campaign. The magicians out in the field by now were poorly paid, and it's not attracting any smart guys to the job. Towns then would allocate funds to hire a lecturer, not a magician, but a lecturer who knows the theology stuff. These guys could then deliver you a nice lecture on our favourite subject, religion. The Archie, of course, hated that idea. Who knows what these guys might say? Archie Lord will chat with Charles, saying a king should be an absolute king, so the Archie should also be the absolute Archie. He wants the right to sack magicians and particularly these new lecturers without any reference to a local bishop or the guys paying their wages. That'll be a 10-4 good buddy from Charles. He didn't really need to overrule the bishops because they weren't happy with these lecturers being employed and diverting much needed cash from their income. Archie Lord will sack the lecturer at Huntingdon. The town will appoint that lecturer to the vacant magician's position and fuck you, Archie. Cromwell is involved in this stuff and getting political lessons. He will also become involved in the Fens dispute, and given he's got a large land parcel at Ely, which is Fen country, he'll be directly involved. We may think of Fens as unproductive land and say it's a good idea to drain them and turn them into agricultural lands, but there are Fen dwellers. These humans have lived there since before Hereward the Wake, as subsistence farmers. Nice eel for dinner, you're thinking, but it's not all underwater, so there's patches where they can run a cow or two as well. Back to being a good idea, but who makes the money? And that would be Charles. And what happens to the Fen dwellers? And that would be Charles not giving a fuck. His idea is that the people exist to serve him and do whatever he says. At this stage then, Oliver is looking to stop the drainers coming in. He will enter into a legal agreement with the Fen dwellers that they will pay him a pittance for each cow they run in there. Legal agreement that these people have rights to stay on the Fen, so no coming in and draining it. The local authorities like that. Oliver is standing up to Charles, so he'll get a job, Commissioner of Sewers. He will also resist the ship tax money and speak in favour of our brave Scotties upholding their religion. He's an agitator against the King and the Archie, and his opinion polls in the anti-King movement are on the up. Keep in mind, Cromwell may have been a poor relative, but he is connected through family to some rich and powerful anti-Charles types. We can get to the 1640 elections for Parliament, and Cromwell is too far away from his old seat at Huntingdon, but he's close enough to stand for Cambridge. Cambridge can elect two guys, and Oliver will be one of those. The other is a King's man. That will be the short Parliament over in 3 weeks, and then we get the next Parliament in the same year. Oliver will be re-elected, but the King's man will fail. Cambridge wanted another anti-King type in. Cromwell is 41 and about to become a big name. Yeah, we'll see. Also elected to that first Parliament, the short Parliament, was Henry German. That shouldn't have happened because he's not a landowner, but he's really well connected. That short Parliament was a big old neon sign of disunity in England and the catalyst for the Scottish marching into the north of England. Charles cobbled together his army and marched north, leaving Queen Mary as regent. She can have a nice taste of power, and she likes the taste of that. At the time, the Queen was well and truly up the spout, but there's Henry German ready to provide support. Queen Mary will make him Keeper of Greenwich Park, a very nice earner. There's talk that he will be made a Viscount and Treasurer of the Royal Household, just talk at the moment. The London anti-Charles gossip is looking for evil advisers, as they do. Could it be his papist missus and her mum, the scheming Marie de Medici? Who cares, it sounds good. Marie de Medici right now is having a big old whinge that she can't sleep at night. The mob is too loud. It'll be a series of unmarked barges to ferry our delicate royals away from Whitehall to the peace and quiet of Oatlands Palace in Surrey. It's noted for its very large silkworm house, designed, of course, by Inigo Jones. That feeds the silk weavers in East End of London to make us nice silk undies or whatever. 8th of July 1641, and Queen Mary will knock out a baby boy, Henry. I don't know, named for the mad Welsh king, or perhaps her dad, Henri of Navarre, or maybe even Henry German. He's the guy on the spot supporting her. Charles can do his deal, if we can even call that. More like a capitulation to the Scotties for me. and come back to London knowing that he has to call Parliament again. The mood in England has worsened towards the King since the short Parliament, and King's supporters are finding it hard to get traction in the election. Safe seats like the one Henry German had are in very short supply. He then will pass these over to Secretary of State Sir Francis Windibank. Hopefully he can counter John Pym. It's going to be a shit sandwich. The Scotties had said they'd march on London if Charles dissolved the Parliament, and they wouldn't go home until Parliament paid them off. So Charles needs that cash plus cash to pay his own army. Parliament, of course, was up for a bit of impeaching. Before they did over Archie Lord and Tom Wentworth, Earl of Strafford, they started with that very Secretary of State, Sir Francis Windibank, and the Lord Keeper, a guy who Queen Mary got into the gig. Those guys smartly headed for the nearest water Uber, pissing off overseas. That's why, when they got to Lord and Wentworth, they were promptly sent to the Tower. Parliament will keep on picking off Charles's top guys one by one, and Henry German, by default, will end up by being one of the top guys in court. But as usual, I am getting ahead of myself.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy.
Thanks, Simon and Garfunkel, for reminding me I was going way too fast. Where we ended up last time was Queen Mary calling Charles a coward for not confronting Parliament. Lucy Hay, our Milady de Winter, sent a message ahead saying Charles is coming to arrest five guys, and those five guys did a runner. Charles came back for Queen Mary to say sorry about my earlier temper tantrum. Rumours are everywhere in London. Charles is going to start hanging members of Parliament will be the big one. Oh dear, we common smellies need to organise ourselves to defend the place and the Parliament. We'll organise a committee of public safety and appoint Puritan military types to command the trained bands. We've had trained bands for a while, but usually in the country. It's like our modern army reserve, civilians who practice warrior stuff now and then. Barricades will be erected on the streets. Cauldrons of boiling water will be put on the city walls, ready to pour on the heads of invading troops. Cannon will be dragged to the walls. Apprentices, iron workers, all sorts will volunteer to be train band guys. Catholic types will have their houses attacked. Any priests we find will be executed. Our five MPs who were in hiding will come out and be paraded around the streets like the heroes we think they are. Now, where's the King? He's done a runner too. The royal family have gone to Windsor. 9-year-old Mary is supposed to be going to Holland to her husband, Prince of Orange, Henry Fred's lad, William, aged 14. This is important, so for once royal protocol is out the window while the family make a mad dash to Dover to get our princess on a water Uber. It'll all be very sad with much boo-hoo-hooing. But we have another Stuart in the Lowlands to marry a power player. Well, future power player, really. It's really looking like Charles will soon be king of nothing. He's tried a bit of appeasement, signing a bill, taking away government jobs from bishops. Here he says, that proves Queen Mary isn't stopping me from doing stuff like that. But now, Parliament will want a bill that would put the army under the control of Parliament, and not the king. That'll be the last straw for Charles. He's up for some biff. Charles and his mates will head north to Hull, which is where we had stashed military supplies for our army to use against the Scotties. Governor of Hull had received a message from Parliament saying, we'll be taking over the army, so keep that stuff safe for us. Governor will have the gates closed to Charles. He'll hop up on the ramparts and say, you can't come in, Charles. Oh, fuck. Off they go to York, where there's a letter from Parliament with 19 demands. Included in this is he has to give him the army, put Parliament in charge of the church, put Parliament in charge of the law, and hand over the royal kiddies. Oh, that'll be a big fuck off from Charles. Parliament will raise 10,000 men. Leader to be the Earl of Essex, who you may know is Robert Devereux, son of the 9 Minute Rebellion guy, and he's Mrs. Frances Walsingham. Robert's cousin, the Earl of Essex, Edward Montagu, is already in charge of the Navy. That's handy, Parliament's got the Navy. 22nd of August 1642, we'll find Charles at Nottingham, where he's going to make his stand. He's managed to collect about 1,500 horse and 1,000 foot. Not much compared to Parliament with their 10,000 guys, and that number is growing. As you might expect, though, lots of places in England just want to keep the fuck out of this thing. Nothing to do with us. Train bands in the north were also not willing to leave their area. Their function is to protect their patch, not go wandering around England. Okay, back to our magnificent king. There he is, he's got his standard planted. Next thing that needs to happen is his herald to read out nice and clear, like, what Charles is on about. Charles had drafted something up, something like, Parliament and their hard men are all traitors and arseholes. But at the last minute he decided to change lots of it. So there's crossings out and different words added, and the whole thing is not that legible, giving the herald a tough gig. The herald will be all Charles says the commons are, oh, what's this word? It's not going well at all. Herald will manage to get to the end of the thing, and then the wind will blow the standard down. Oh dear. Henry German, finding lots of top dogs taken down by Parliament, has become pretty much the top dog himself. Shit timing, because we're in a total crisis. But opportunities will come his way. Here's Marie de Medici with a cunning plan. Fred Henry, Prince of Orange, isn't really a prince. Nor is he really Orange. No, that's King Donald I who's Orange. Thing is, when the duchies first booted the Spanish out of their patch, they needed a functioning government, so invented the States General. It's like a republic that's run by a parliament. Just, that's what it's called, States General and not Parliament. The princes of Orange became the military leaders called Stadtholders. I say prince because for some reason the Estates General decided it would be hereditary. Dick of an idea, but so far it's actually worked. Current Prince of Orange is Fred Henry, who is in charge of a large army and a large navy, but he wants more. He wants to be a real prince, a sovereign ruler. It was Marie de Medici's idea then to marry off our Princess Mary to Fred Henry's son. She will provide the royal DNA to the family, and in the future, we'll see if that's going to work. While Tom Wentworth was facing trial in Parliament, Henry German was having top secret talks with a couple of duchies. He's also having deep and meaningful talks with the power players like courtiers and parliamentarians, sounding them out on a new government that would support the king. The plan is to do what they did with Tom Wentworth, offer big carrots but on a much larger scale. Even the dreaded Pym is to be offered Chancellor of the Exchequer. Not bad for a guy who'd just been a minor clerk in the Exchequer. Will he take it? Well, no, 7 guys, they will take a deal. More, including the all-important Pym, will not. Henry German has gone on Pym's naughty list. What else have we got? Well, there was that big army hanging out in Ireland. Tom Wentworth intended to bring them to England to smack down the Scotties, but even Charles could see that bringing a big bunch of Irish to England would not go down well at all. Replacing Tom Wentworth in Ireland was Catholic Lord Conington, who said, hey, I can sack those Protestant soldiers and get Catholics to replace them. Dear me! So now the proposal is not only to bring Irish, but bring Catholic Irish to England. Oh yeah, great, no thanks, we won't be doing that. All we can do is head north and then bring the army down from there. We'll still be at the thinking hard about it stage when in comes Captain James Chudley from that very large army hanging round the north. He's brought in a petition saying Parliament needs to let Charles pay them. Oddly enough, the first guy Chudley bumped into was Davenant, our poet, who will direct him to Henry German. At this stage, Tom Wentworth's trial was still going on, so Henry knows he has a petition that can be turned into a political tool. Henry will assure Chudleigh that the Parliament were too in love with the Scotties to pay, but Charles would pawn his jewels before he allows them to go unpaid. A couple more things were going on. Charles has recruited a guy, George Goring, to head up the army. He's a good pick, seasoned warrior, liked by the troops, totally loyal. Loves a booze, that might come unstuck for him. One of the endless Henry Percys, this one being a younger brother to the Earl of Northumberland, with a bunch of army officers, want to go and get the army in the north and declare that they are totally on Team Charles and will be happy to belt up Parliament. Henry German will bring all these guys together now and tell them his plan. That is, bring the army south and take over the Tower. Oh dear, just what Londoners hate. A big bunch of hairy northerners coming to London. Yeah, like they really don't want anybody coming to London, thanks. The army types aren't too happy with that idea, particularly given that it's Henry German and a couple of his poet mates trying to lead this thing. But at this stage they'll go along with it. Charles at least gets that bringing northerners to London is a bad idea, so he'll squash it. George Goring will be pissed off at this news and further pissed off that he finds out that while the soldiers like him, our conspiring officers don't like him. He will spill the beans to Lord Newport, who is pissed off with Henry German because he's been one of those banging Eleanor Villiers and Henry had outed him. Lord Newport will be straight off to Parliament to tell Pym what was going down. This, of course, could be a disinformation exercise. Perhaps Charles wanted Pym to find out and put the frighteners on Parliament. Henry German was leaking information that a French army was on its way to help Charles. The only real result was that Pym ramped up the campaign to get Tom Wentworth's head off. So that's when Pym will go for the bill of attainder idea. Then there's no need to continue the trial. We'd still like to take the Tower, though. That's where the gunpowder is stored. An opportunity will arise when William of Orange turns up to marry Princess Mary. He's brought a bodyguard of 400 Dutchy hardmen. Our guys will look to recruit 100 Londoners on the pretence that they will be going to the King of Portugal, but what he really wants them to do is slip into the Tower and let the 400 Dutchies in. Off go the 100 Londoners to the Tower. Let us in, mate. Charles has sent us to guard the gunpowder. No, not letting you in, so that's that. That plan's dead. There will be a quiet little wedding then with a message from the House of Lords. Disband those 100 guys. Charles will say no. The Lords will send a delegation saying, please disband those 100 guys. And in the meantime, they'll appoint Lord Newport as commander of the Tower. 4 days later in Parliament, dilly-dallying over executing Tom Wentworth. Pym will now stand up and spill all this stuff about marching an army on London and taking over the Tower to get gunpowder, and Parliament is shocked. All in favour of having Tom's head off. Aye. Then a message to Charles requesting he arrest the Queen's household for plotting against Parliament. We are so indignant, then angry, then shock horror. This looks like Henry German will be following Tom Wentworth to a de-heading. No, it's worse. Henry German has no title, so no fast head off. At best it would be a hanging, at worst a full tortured death, and the worst is most likely. Charles will scratch out a quick passport and Henry German won't even change his undies. He's on his bike to Portsmouth for a fast water Uber to France. It'll be one of those tense thingies. Parliamentarian soldiers will arrive at Portsmouth at pretty much the same time the ship sailed for France. Queen Mary will write to her sister, Christina Savoy, saying all she can do is boo-hoo-hoo. She'll tell a priest that she's also heading off to Portsmouth. He'll say, oh, you know, can do, Queen. If you do, the world will know you're chasing after your lover. She will settle for Oatlands Palace and Charles will sign that death warrant for Tom Wentworth. Well, in fact, he won't. He'll get a couple of guys to sign on his behalf. William of Orange will head home, taking Marie de Medici with him. She'll be dead in a year, totally broke. The artist Rubens took her in for her last year. Henry German will be tried in absentia. Guilty, sentenced death. Parliament will pass a bill saying that Parliament can't be dissolved. Some of the other guys have managed to get to France. Henry Percy was wounded and has a fever. Poet Davenant hadn't got away and he's on trial. Henry will be off to see Richelieu to see if he will help. Nah. The lads will hang around Paris. Percy will get better and join them, then in rides Davenant. Pym was okay with executing military or government types, but executing a poet could turn him into a martyr. More famous poet and firm Republican John Milton had also intervened for Davenant. Another of the Royalist plotters, a poet and wannabe soldier, had not escaped. It wasn't Parliament, it was his own servant who wanted to rob him. For some reason I can't think of, this dickhead servant hid a razor in our poet's boot. That razor opened up an artery and the guy just bled to death. Always check your boots, my dear listener. There could be a funnel web spider lurking in there. When the family went to Dover to send Princess Mary... Oh, poor little dicky bird flew into the window. That's all right, he flew away, but he's going to have a headache, I'd say. Now, what was I saying? When the family went to Dover to send Princess Mary off to William of Orange, Queen Mary decided to go too. Charles would go home to try and arrest Pym and the other four. They got advance warning, so another dud at the arrest attempt. Charles can head off to join his army while Queen Mary is to pawn the crown jewels and raise cash for him. Henry German will rush the lowlands to be with the Queen. Bordegaard say, no. The Dutch Republic are fans of the English Parliament, not the Royalists. He'll have to knock around in Spanish-held territory while Queen Mary can write to Charles saying, I have zero support team. Fred Henry will have a chat to the border guys saying, hey guys, come over here and just don't look there while Henry German walks into the place. Percy, Davenant and German will be back with the Queen. Henry German will get to work finalising loans and buying hard men equipment. Parliamentary spies operating in the lowlands will be alarmed to see 80 English and Frenchy hard men volunteers with Henry German and a Frenchy big name Marquis of somewhere or other, I can't pronounce where he's from. The ships are loading supplies for Charles. Henry will also become Queen Mary's cipher guy. She and Charles were writing in cipher to each other, but Mary wasn't very good at it. She sent a message and the reply was, look, you fucked this cipher up, I don't know what you're saying. So she'll ask permission for Henry to act for her, and he'll now know the intimate correspondence between King and Queen. Now that's got me back to the magnificent speech that Charles wished his herald had made and the falling over of the standard. 22nd of August 1642, the Civil War can begin. Great. Henry and Queen Mary will hire 200 Dutchy hard men and get 18 ships to carry men and ammunition to Portsmouth. Parliament is besieging the place with George Goring in there defending. Okay, ships good to go, and the local authorities will empower them. Henry German will go to protest and be tossed in the slammer. Henry Fred will take a couple of weeks to get Henry out and the ships released.
Thank God I am free, free, free from this world of sin.
Yes, the rather young Detty sisters there, letting you know, my dear listener, that you can be free. All you need to do is sign up for the Baby Jesus Club. Other ships led by the Earl of Newcastle, William Cavendish, he's the grandson of our Bishop of Hardwick, will head on up north to help the army up there. Davenant's ship will be captured by parliamentarians. He's really unhappy because he really wanted to be a soldier. As for the rest of the fleet, wind has changed and they're just bobbing around going nowhere. It won't be until January 1643 that the wind changes and Henry with Queen Mary can hop onto a ship and we're off. Henry and the Queen are headed north, and north they will go at a good gallop. They'll get to York, where it's just a bit too rough to land. Wind will change, and they will go at a gallop all the way back to the lowlands. By the 10th of February, they'll get to Yorkshire, and in comes William Cavendish with the army. Nice dinner and early night for our weary travellers. 5 a.m, and it's cannon. A parliamentary squadron of ships are firing on the town, and houses nearby are being smashed up. Henry will rush into Queen Mary's bedroom and drag her out, still in a nightie. She'll scream and run back into the house. She'd left the little doggie behind. Off they go, running through the streets with much alarm. Cannonballs and bullets are coming in. A servant running with them will cop it. Yeah, he's dead. Henry and Queen Mary will hop into a ditch. It's February in the north of England, and it's pretty cold. Best to share some body warmth, I would think. Duchy Admiral will manage to get his ships into position to fire on the parliamentary ships, and parliamentary ships will run away. Time to shift camp, and we'll be going 3 miles inland. And recruit, and they'll do well. Okay, they've got some guys ready to send to William Cavendish to push the parliamentarians out of England. But in comes a help-wanted message from Charles. So we better see what he's been up to. We left him with his standard falling over. It's a really bad look. At that point, he had only about 1,000 guys. These guys are just guys that are loyal to the crown. Doesn't matter whose head's got it on. It's a civil war, so plenty would be hanging back to see which side will come out on top. Others would want to be loyal to the crown, except that Charles is a dick. And it's harvest time, so lots just want to bring in the harvest rather than play soldiers. Leader of Team Parliament thought he would have no chance in getting Parliament to agree to some biff. Those 19 propositions they sent to Charles were just never ever going to get up. It was provocation. But our man was wrong. Parliament is up for biff. Declaration that any men who don't support Parliament are delinquents and will forfeit their property. Nobody can be neutral. Great. Charles will get more recruits. Some landowners who are going down financially, though, will declare for Team Parliament. If somebody's land's going to be forfeited, they might pick it up. This is causing more upheaval. Rich guys who decide to support the king are worried that the common smellies in their patch might rebel. Both Puritans and merchants will use this declaring for one side or the other as a lever to get what they want. Towns will have to amend policies to get the mob behind whichever team they picked. There's also a bit of a geographical divide. The North are generally pro-Charles and law and order, being against Parliament and anarchy. London and the South are generally pro-Parliament and reform, and against dicks who want to be an absolute monarch. Trading towns mostly declare for Parliament, who represent economic reform. Lots of towns will still try for neutrality. Families will divide. People will swap back and forth. Agricultural workers will just be told which side they're on, not that they care much. Why give a fuck who's in charge if you're a labourer? Some parts of England don't even know about the thing. Overall, about 3% of the population will be involved. Some guys come into Charles bringing their farm hands only to be told to take them home again. We'd like to wait for better guys to come along before handing out weapons. It's handy that there are those trained bands in the country for Charles, except it's not. London was about the only place where they actually trained. The guys in the country said, yeah, sure, we'll do some training, but they didn't. There wasn't enough trained military leaders to show them what to do. England's not what it used to be. We have a bunch of guys who aren't trained and don't have discipline. They're interested in the good old rape, loot and plunder, but there won't be a lot of that. Towns will close their gates, then the leader will negotiate from the walls to pay them off. Earl of Leicester, Robert Sidney, will pay £500 for him to go away. Good investment. Let's check in on the well-disciplined troops of Parliament, then. They aren't well-disciplined. They're wandering around in bands, looting churches and making mischief. They're even ransacking the quarters of their own leaders to steal stuff. Overall leader of this army is Robert Devereux, Earl of Essex. Need I say more? He's an amateur soldier, but a strong Puritan. He's still smarting that his Mrs. Frances Howard went off with Robert Carr. Devereux, though, has copped a break with Charles giving overall command to Robert Bertie, Earl of Lindsay, who is about as bad a soldier as Devereux. Both teams, then, are being led by duds. But then Charles will cop a break because in comes mighty hero, 23-year-old Rupert, son of Fred and Elizabeth, whose military career so far has been, well, a failure. There's no doubt this guy is brave, and he does understand a thing or two about cavalry. Trouble is, he doesn't know the third thing, which is how to use cavalry to support foot soldiers. So the cavalry will go to Rupert, and Robert Bertie will be in charge of the army, except the cavalry. Rupert had just arrived from the Lowlands, where he'd been fighting with Queen Mary and Henry Jermyn. Mary wrote to Charles saying, "Whatever you do, don't give this dick any sort of independent command." But that's what Charles did anyway. He's a super fancy pants dresser and will charm the English by being arrogant, bad-tempered and soggy. His manners are poor and his bad taste is on display in his fancy pants outfits. Okay, I'll bag the guy, but he's also intelligent, a very good linguist, pretty good artist and inventor. His manners with the big dicks may be poor, but as a student he would dress down and go to the boozer with the sailors. He had what you call the common touch. The many commands like the lad, and better they trust him to lead him to certain victory. Yeah, they might not know about his track record. Another thing Rupert had going for him was good luck. He's got out of some tight scrapes where he really should have been killed. The opposition, who will be known as the Roundheads with close-cropped hair, will be a bit afraid of him and resort to insults. He's protected by the devil. They also don't get it that he carries a little white poodle with him everywhere, even in a battle. It's been trained to jump in the air if Rupert says Charles and cock his leg and pee if Rupert says Pim. For the Roundheads, the poodle is a spy that can get through their lines, then report numbers and formations back to Rupert. Yeah, really? Rupert will win the first engagement. Just a skirmish, really. Battle of Powick Bridge, where parliamentarians are waiting to ambush a supply train. Out they come, but Rupert will see them off. Records are sketchy, but Rupert lost maybe 30 guys and parliamentarians about 150. Month later, 23rd of October 1642, and battle. Battle of Edgehill. Both sides were rather surprised to find that they were close to each other. Best bet is to form up. Rupert can kick off by telling Army Commander Robert Bertie he's got no idea what he's doing. "Yeah, Bertie, you've got no fucking clue, mate." Bertie will crack the shits and say, "I'm not doing this anymore. I'll bravely lead the troops from the front and surely die a glorious hero." That's okay, there's plenty more to pick from. So Sir Jacob Astley, Baron of Reading, will take over. He can say a prayer that will become rather famous for soldiers. "O Lord, thou knowest how busy I must be this day. If I forget thee, do not thou forget me." Charles will also pray, then make the inspiring speech. "Your king is both your cause, your quarrel, and your captain. The foe is in sight. The best encouragement I can give you is this, that come life or death, your king will bear your company and ever keep this field, this place, and this day's service in his grateful remembrance." He may not be remembered that well. Rupert can address his troops. "Remember my complex battle plan. Smash into the fuckers and kill them." Off goes Rupert and his brave boys and smash into the fuckers and kill them. He smashed into the enemy cavalry, so then he's going to go and chase them for about a mile. Dickhead. By the time he got back, the Roundheads were well and truly into the king's line. His standard, just back from the laundry after falling in the mud, will be taken. Oh dear. Standard bearer Sir Edmund Verney, who had gone on the dickhead trip to Spain with Charles and George, has gone with the Valkyries to Valhalla. Robert Bertie, Earl of Lindsay and former leader of the army, will get his wish. Fatal wound saying he would never fight with boys again. Which is dead right, because, well, that wound is fatal. He's dead. The action had come so close to Prince Charles that he cocked his pistol saying, "Let me at him." They won't let him at him. Exciting battle so far, I suppose, but apart from Prince Rupert's charge of magnificence, it was a bit of a shit show. Untrained troops on both sides. The parliamentarian soldiers wore an orange scarf so we'd all know who they were. One of Charles's guys would just grab an orange scarf and then wander over to the parliamentarian lines and retrieve the royal standard. The two teams had about the same number of guys, say 15,000, and both had about the same number of casualties, about 500 dead and 1,500 wounded. Both sides are wondering who won. The easiest way to tell this is whichever side leaves the field first, they're the losers. It will get dark and both sides will stay put. Charles won't be able to get to sleep. There's dead guys nearby, and it's a bit cold. Charles had manned up for the battle, no more indecisiveness, no more thinking about debate, and now it's down to God to award victory to his best boy. But this battle has shaken him up, and he's back to doubt and indecision. Rupert will say, "We need to rush back to London to break up the Parliament." Good plan, but Charles is, "I don't know." Yes, he's indecisive. Meantime, Robert Devereux will come up with something better. He'll declare he won and march back on London. Charles can take Banbury to resupply, but a number of his guys have wandered off home, and they took their guns with them. Both sides will ask London for money. London will say, "No, look, you need to sit down and talk this out. It's time for a treaty." "Oh, good ideas," say both sides. "Good," says London. "Start off by standing down your armies and putting your guns away." "No way," say both sides. Parliament will march an army out past Westminster. Charles will wander past Oxford and Reading towards Brentwood. Rupert will do a surprise motherfucker, plundering and setting fire to houses and doing over any resistance. And we've made a start on non-combatant deaths. Spoiler, more non-combatants will die than soldiers in this big old bun fight. Nothing unusual, really. Charles will come in the next day and say, "Great, those pissed off Londoners are now hopping mad due to Rupert's burning places and killing people." And out come the Londoners in their thousands to line up behind the parliamentary army. They've moved cannon to the streets of London and erected barricades again. Earl of Essex, Robert Devereux, will ride his horsey up and down the troops. "Come on, my boys, my brave boys, let us pray heartily and fight heartily. I will run the same fortunes and hazards with you. Remember, the cause is for God." But it's Sunday, so the two sides will just glare at each other. Charles will have to wander off and he's going to Oxford, which is going to become Team Royal Headquarters. The colleges can be turned into quarters for the army and storerooms for the weapons. Astronomy and music schools will be turned into workrooms for tailors to make proper uniforms. The Law and Logic School will store horsey food. The quadrangle at Christchurch will be a cattle pen. Oxford has become a garrison town. Students will help out working on fortifications. For the nobles, there will, of course, be entertainments, plays, sonnets, satires, fashion parades, all the usual. Does it sound like a well-oiled machine? It isn't, of course. Plenty of fights. Military disagreements, soldiers who want to get involved in politics and politicians who want to get involved with soldiering. Catholics unhappy with Protestants who are unhappy with Catholics. Ultra-royalists versus moderates and those all versus reactionaries. It's not going well at all. But we will work out one thing. We need more guys. Best bet he's in the north, where for some reason they seem to like Charles. Should also be able to get guys from the west and southwest. So William Cavendish, Earl of Newcastle, can head north to pick up guys and then march on London. Sir Ralph Hopton, Baron Hopton, who has experience at losing battles under Count Mansfeld, can head down to Cornwall and Devon, getting guys to march on London. And the King will pick up more guys from the west and march on London. That plan can't fail. Cavendish will defeat a parliamentary force in Yorkshire that was led by their top military type. Southwest and Baron Hopton will defeat the Roundheads at Stratton, then march on to Somerset to meet up with more Royalists. It's going well, isn't it? Better. Royalist victories continue in Bath and Devizes, and Rupert will storm Bristol and take it, and the men of Kent will rise, as they do, and they've declared for Team Charles. Brilliant. Nothing can stop us. Of course it can. All those guys we'd raised were fine fighting in or near their own counties, but marching on London is not something they want to do. Plenty are wandering off home, saying, I did my bit. A lot of the guys in the west were from Plymouth, and they're not going anywhere but home with a garrison being left in the town. The guys in the north went as far south as Lincoln, but that was their limit. If they don't go back north, then who knows what the Scotties might do. Change of royal plans. If they can't march on London, then Gloucester is a good option. Held by Parliamentarians, so if they could take that, they would control the Severn River and get to South Wales, where the Welsh are totally on Team Charles. Common smellies in Gloucester aren't up for a ruler's takeover and will put up a big defence. Robert Devereux will be so impressed he'll ask the train bands to go there and help out. Off they go, without provisions, of course. But they are sturdy Englishmen, so they'll get there tired, hungry, and ready to rumble. When I say there, not Gloucester. Royals had already given it up, but it's a royal army. Rupert will say we should get out of here. Ammo is low, but there's more on the way from Oxford, so we should wait for that. Fuck that, say the other big dicks. We could defeat this scum with butter knives. So, battle with the royals, soon running out of ammunition, and the ground is no good for Rupert and his brave horsey boys, so they will nick off. Now, I skipped over that, but it was a 4-hour job, with both sides losing about 1,200 guys. Charles's secretary, Lord Falkland, will be off Devon. Meanwhile, back in Parliament, we have a peace-loving lentils party and a let's-kill-all-the-fuckers party, and John Pym seems to be losing control of the thing. Algernon Percy, the Earl of Northumberland, has been to Oxford to peace talks on behalf of the Parliament. He did no good. Londoners have got the news of those royalist victories and are annoyed that Parliament are grabbing cash to fund their troops, so they'll start demonstrating for peace and call for Pym to be handed over. Pym doesn't care much. By now he's exhausted and he's dying from cancer. But while the biff was going on, he was negotiating with the Scotties. Parliament will guarantee that the Scotties can do the Presbyterian thing and that the Anglican thing would be reformed to kind of Presbyterian in exchange for the Scotties' help. And hey, Scotties, just to prove that we are totally fair dinkum, we'll pop the head right off Archie Lord. There goes the Archie. Great, say the Scotties, and sure, we'll be happy to help out. And York, the King's power base, is now under siege from the Scotties. Common smellies in London feel a bit happier now. Charles has gone back to Oxford. Bad news. He's lost guys, and sure, Parliament has too, but Parliament are getting plenty of new guys in, and Charles isn't. Let's also remember that Parliament has the Navy, so resupplying is pretty easy for them. Morale of the parliamentary soldiers is on the rise. Charles's big dicks are also quarrelling amongst themselves. And then Queen Mary had turned up. Total shit trip. Those 9 days of storms only to be pushed back to Holland. Then 10 days later, easy trip that will get her to Yorkshire, where those parliamentarians start sending cannon her way, and a nice chilly night in the ditch with Henry Jermyn. Her letters from Yorkshire to Charles give us a very strong indication that she'd rushed home, because without her to stiffen his upper lip, she thought that Charles would just fold. Having got Charles and Queen Mary back at the same time, I think we'll leave it for this week. And just a little bit there of Wes Montgomery to get us into some historical fiction. And I had fun in the company of Harold Hardrada this week. Novel called Viking Fire by Justin Hill. Got a couple of gongs, I think, so it's not just me who thought it was a good read. This is, of course, Harold Hardrada, who will eventually die at the Battle of Stamford Bridge, courtesy of Harold Godwinson in 1066. It's a lovely little account, nice read. I can recommend it, Justin Hill, Viking Fire. Also had a bit of a squiz at a TV series called El Cid. This is Rodrigo Diaz de Vivar, who would have been about 23 when Harold Hardrada went down. Spanish guy, warlord who did rather well. I first came across the guy in the 1961 movie El Cid, but it starred Charlton Heston, and he's just one of those guys, I just don't like him. But this TV series is pretty bloody good. Made in Spain, of course, so you have to do the subtitles, which I'm fine with. In this one, the king will die and, of course, split up the kingdom amongst his three sons, because that always goes so well, does it not, my dear listener? Goes terrifically well, that stuff. And the kings all act like spoiled toddlers, but that's probably how it was. So it's two seasons, five episodes each of El Cid. I can thoroughly recommend that for you. But for us, it's just a matter of what we come out with. Spanish prog rock band put out a track about El Cid, so we might go out with that. Now let me see, can I say the bloody thing? Marchando una del Cid. Let's give it a go. Hope to see you next week. Bye.